I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. While the death of Freddie Gray and excessive force by police brought demonstrators to the streets of Baltimore, a deeper look at the city's problems brings us to social and economic conditions, starting with the concentration of poverty on the west and east sides of the city. A new study by Harvard economists confirms the complaint that many Baltimoreans feel trapped in poverty, unable to reach communities within our relatively wealthy region that offer more opportunities for their children. Raj Chetty, co-author of the study, joins us in this hour of Midday to talk about the importance of place in the life of children in the city and in the suburbs. Our conversation about Baltimore continues after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Today, we continue our look inward at Baltimore in the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray and the riots and unrest that followed his funeral. Yesterday, we spent an hour on the high concentration of poor people in inner-city Baltimore and the problems such de facto segregation creates not only for the men, women, and children who live in those conditions, but for the larger city and the still larger metropolitan area. Today, a specific look at how poverty and place affects children. We're pleased to have with us Harvard economist Raj Chetty, who with colleagues released groundbreaking research this month on the role that geography plays in shaping a child's chances of future success. They looked at the 100 largest municipal jurisdictions in America, including Baltimore and the surrounding counties, and what they learned about Baltimore children, particularly boys, would seem to confirm the complaint heard in the aftermath of the April rioting that too many people in high poverty neighborhoods feel trapped there, that life offers them few good options, that they can't reach what some researchers call high opportunity areas outside of the inner city. So Raj Chetty, I want to welcome you to the Midday Show on WYPR and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You went and looked back at Moving to Opportunity. MTO is the program. Its aim was to move poor people into neighborhoods with better schools, better living conditions, and more job opportunities on the theory that a better environment would encourage their climb out of poverty. I remember when MTO came to Baltimore, in the Baltimore area, it was very controversial. But you looked specifically at this idea of whether moving children specifically out of high poverty areas early in life can make a difference.
That's right. So we revisited the widely studied Moving to Opportunity experiment, which involved 5,000 families or so in Baltimore and other big cities around the U.S. And what that experiment did, to put it in concrete terms in the context of Baltimore, was help families move out of high poverty public housing projects like the Poe Homes, for example, to places like the Lakeland area of the city of Baltimore, which is a more of a mixed-income neighborhood, lower poverty rates, less concentrated poverty. So basically families were given, through a randomized lottery, subsidized housing vouchers to move out of very high poverty areas. And what we found when we reanalyzed that data and tracked kids over a 20-year period to look at how much they're earning, whether they went to college and so on as adults, we found really striking effects that the kids whose families by chance had gotten a voucher to move to an area like Lakeland out of the high-poverty public housing projects were earning 30% more, they were 27% more likely to go to college, they were 25% less likely to become single parents. So just that simple move of moving about 10 miles away, typically, out of the highest poverty areas of a city to lower poverty areas, for young kids had really large lasting benefits.
And the best time for moving, could you assess that? I mentioned, significant benefits for kids who move before the age of 13, but even younger, right?
Yeah, that's right. So what we find is a very clear pattern of childhood exposure effects. That is, every extra year you spend in a better environment seems to improve children's outcomes. So earlier studies of the Moving to Opportunity experiment had actually been somewhat disappointing in that they found little evidence of economic gains, but they focused mainly on adults and older youth at the point of the move. And they ended up finding that there were small gains or no gains for those groups. What we find is if you look at kids who moved when they were younger, you see really dramatic gains. And so more broadly, both in the Moving to Opportunity study and in a broader study involving 5 million families that moved across all counties of the United States, we find that every extra year you spend in a better environment improves children's outcomes. So if you move at age 5 instead of age 8 instead of age 11, the gains are bigger and bigger when you move at earlier ages.
The areas of the United States, and let's just talk about the Baltimore area, where kids have the most opportunity, have largely white populations. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So when we do this analysis, now going beyond Baltimore to all cities of the U.S., we find that areas where kids have the best chances of moving up in the income distribution tend to be places with larger white populations. But importantly, we find that both whites and blacks have lower rates of upward mobility in areas where there are larger African-American populations. So cities like Atlanta, cities in the Southeast, for example, which have larger African-American populations, tend to have lower rates of mobility, not just for the blacks, but also for the whites as well. So it's something about the place and not just race. And that's very important because it means that these place effects, these neighborhood effects, are amplifying racial inequality in the United States because blacks, on average, seem to live in neighborhoods with less opportunity, which exacerbates the black-white earnings gap.
I mentioned that your study shows that it's tougher for boys even than for girls, poor kids in Baltimore, tougher even for boys. Boys are at the rock bottom here in terms of what they can expect to earn over a lifetime, their quality of life if they grow up poor in Baltimore City. Why more for boys than girls?
Yeah, so a striking pattern we find in the data, and we noticed this actually right before the riots in Baltimore, is that Baltimore, among the list of the 100 largest counties in the U.S., comes out at the very bottom in terms of its impacts on kids' earnings. So we estimate that if a child grows up in Baltimore instead of an average place in America, that given child will earn 15% less on average, something like 20% less on average than if they grew up in the average place. And if you look just at boys, we estimate that if you grew up in Baltimore instead of an average place in America, you're earning on average 30% less than in a comparable, than in an average city. In contrast, the effect for girls is something like minus 8% or 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So why is the effect so much bigger for boys than for girls? Well, we find the places that are really detrimental for boys are cities with very high levels of concentrated poverty, high levels of crime, gang violence, and so forth. And Baltimore, I think, unfortunately, fits many of those narratives where boys who are in low-income families can easily get into trouble in a way that I think girls are a little bit more resistant to getting involved in crime and so forth.
When you look at these outcomes nationally, Raj, Baltimore comes in at the very bottom. That's been reported in the press a number of times. That's a correct interpretation of your data, what your data shows.
Yeah, that's correct. And I want to be clear that it's not just that Baltimore comes out at the bottom because of the type of people living in Baltimore. What we find when we analyze families that move across areas is moving to Baltimore and spending additional years of childhood in Baltimore, every extra year you spend in Baltimore, we estimate, reduces your earnings by something like 1% to 2%. So when you add that up over 20 years of childhood, there's a 30% earnings loss. So this is, we think, a causal effect of growing up in Baltimore instead of growing up in the surrounding metro areas. And there are many places right next to Baltimore in the suburbs of D.C. and the suburbs of Baltimore that generate much better outcomes for kids. So I think this is an unfortunate reality that one has to confront, that it's actually a causal effect of growing up in Baltimore that kids have reduced opportunities for upward mobility.
A few historic notes here for our audience, Raj. Moving to Opportunity developed after, this is a HUD program, it was developed after the riots in Los Angeles in the early 90s, and it was carried out in different places around the country. It stopped in its tracks in Baltimore after a short period of time. By 1994, one of the senators in Maryland, Barbara Mikulski, was spearheading a congressional effort to kill the program, designed to move poor families out of the inner city to better neighborhoods, mostly in the suburbs. And there was an uproar here in eastern Baltimore County, resistance to this idea of moving poor people out of the city, giving them vouchers. So the politics got involved here. And so we didn't really have an MTO in place in Baltimore after 1994.
Right. And there is a lot of political resistance, I think, to programs that try to integrate low-income families. And I think some of that concern comes from people maybe reasonably being concerned that when low-income families move into a given higher-income neighborhood, maybe the kids in the higher-income or middle-income families will be negatively affected, even if the low-income kids gain. Now, one reassuring thing we find in our broader study of the 5 million families that moved across areas is the places that generate better outcomes for low-income kids do not typically generate worse outcomes for high-income kids. So let me give you an example. A city like Seattle, which is a much more integrated city than Baltimore, where the low-income and the high-income people are living in closer proximity to each other, that city not only generates better outcomes for kids from low-income families, but it if anything, generates slightly better outcomes for kids in high-income families as well. So it doesn't seem like there's this hard trade-off between generating better outcomes for the poor through integration and generating good outcomes for kids from more affluent families. And I think that should hopefully quell some of the political concerns that you're going to hurt more affluent families by increasing integration.
Yeah. I mean, since the MTO experiment here was stopped dead in its tracks, we have had a federal court case, federal court settlement that we discussed on the show yesterday, and slowly over the years, some 2,800 families from high-poverty areas, formerly in public housing in Baltimore, have moved to other parts of Baltimore City that are low-poverty and the suburbs that are low-poverty. So that's been happening anyway because of a court case, but it didn't happen here because of MTO. I was curious where MTO has been successful based on your research and your measurement of success. What kind of scale are we talking about in terms of the numbers of children who manage to get out of high-poverty areas?
Well, the MTO experimental intervention itself was relatively small. It involved only 5,000 families or so.
Total.
But MTO is part of a broader program on which we spend about $20 billion a year, the Section 8 housing voucher program administered by HUD, where we give families subsidized housing vouchers to try to help them move to better areas. And we think some of the lessons from the study suggest that those housing vouchers can be quite effective, especially if they're targeted at families with young kids, where you get the biggest benefits, and if they encourage families to move specifically to lower poverty neighborhoods, which is what MTO did, to better neighborhoods. Currently, you get a subsidized housing voucher that doesn't really encourage you to move to a particular area, and we think it's quite important to encourage families to move to more mixed-income neighborhoods because that's where kids seem to have better outcomes in the long run.
Hmm. You know, Raj, whenever we get into this subject, generally I'll hear people say, I'll get an email or someone will call our show or I'll get a comment from someone who says, well, poor people need to stop having children. They have too many children. Do that. Why don't they do that? You know, too many teenage girls getting pregnant, that's the problem. The theory here is, that you accept that reality, or you don't accept that reality. You do other things to try to reduce teenage pregnancy, for instance. But accepting the reality that there are children growing up in poverty and they do not do well in poverty, the theory is if you move them to areas where they see a different lifestyle, where they don't have that, what David Rusk, the urban scholar, calls the constant radioactivity around them of poverty, they do better. That's the theory, and I guess your research would confirm a lot of those who believe that.
That's exactly right, Dan. And I would say it's more than a theory at this point. I mean, I think we see that very clearly in the data. There's clear evidence that, poverty's not a completely intractable problem. It's true that there are issues that I think stem from the family environment and teenage birth and so on that have quite negative effects. But what these results are showing is that we can actually change these outcomes. One of the things we see is, in addition to kids having higher earnings if they move out of these low poverty areas, they're actually less likely to have teenage births as well. They're less likely to become single parents and so on. And so that suggests one of the ways in which you might be able to influence teenage births, to the extent that that is one of the channels we're concerned about, is again by changing neighborhoods and changing the level of poverty in which kids are growing up.
Raj Chetty, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Yep. Thank you for your research. We're going to hear some more about moving to opportunity as we move along here. Raj Chetty, economist at Harvard. You can find a link to his study and information, more information about children growing up in poverty and their upward mobility on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. More on this topic when we come back on Midday. We'll hear from a pediatrician and researcher at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health on health impacts of moving to opportunity, MTO. How does living in an area of concentrated poverty affect children's health? Can moving to better areas reverse the negative effects of living in a high-crime, low-income area? More on Midday when we get back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here as we're looking at Moving to Opportunity, this federal program that was put in place in the early 1990s. And as I said during my chat with Raj Chetty, it did come to a stunning halt here in Baltimore. In 1994, Senator Mikulski spearheaded a congressional effort to kill the program. Congress had $170 million lined up in 1994 to expand the program. Moving to Opportunity, setting aside money for a counseling program for Section 8 recipients who are employed or in job training. And that's who the program was aimed at, working poor families. And Baltimore was one of five cities participating in MTO. It was a pilot program designed by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And a similar program, as Raj Chetty's research shows, improved the lives of poor people in Chicago. But here it became a lightning rod. Residents of specifically eastern Baltimore County and the politicians attacked the program, saying it would push crime into the neighborhoods. I remember one local elected official saying that poor people don't know how to bathe. People in the suburbs would be dealing with dirty, poor people. Anyway, Senator Mikulski pulled the plug on this. She said at the time that she opposed MTO because it had been mishandled by local agencies charged with implementing it. And she had used her post. She was on the, in fact, she was chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees HUD at the time. This was, 20 years ago. But she had used her position there to secure $50 million in federal money to rebuild the Lafayette Courts public housing project in East Baltimore, which was a high-rise that is gone now, that was torn down just a few years later. So this is a historic note for you. Barbara Mikulski, a champion of liberal causes, they say, led the fight to kill MTO in the 1990s. Anyway, that's what happened here, and now you're hearing data taking a look at MTO over a much longer period of time than earlier research, showing some improvement in the lives of children who move out of poverty. Joining us now is Dr. Rachel Johnson Thornton, a pediatrician at the Children's Medical Practice at Johns Hopkins Bayview and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Thornton has studied Moving to Opportunity, MTO, this program, to see how moving from high poverty to low-poverty neighborhoods influences children's health. She's also studied how policy interventions in early childhood can improve outcomes for kids over their lifetime. So, Dr. Thornton, I want to thank you for joining us on the Midday Show here.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, you know, you think about moving to opportunity, better jobs, better schools. I didn't think off the top of my head about better health, but I guess that would be an element of this. How do you measure, and in your research, your look at MTO, measure better health outcomes for kids?
Well, that's a great question. And just to be clear, I'm familiar with the research that many others have really spearheaded on looking at the health impacts of the Moving to Opportunity for Fair Housing demonstration. And there was a landmark study by Jens Ludwig and colleagues that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine just a few years ago, actually demonstrating that people who moved with the vouchers and the counseling to go to low-poverty neighborhoods actually demonstrated decreases in obesity and diabetes risk compared to adults who did not have the opportunity to move or stayed in the public housing. And there's also been some evaluations, extensive evaluations of the Moving to Opportunity study data looking at mental health outcomes for children and adults. And, you know, I think the results from those are generally quite positive. In particular, some more recent studies, one by Kessler and colleagues, looked at the impacts on mental health and found some very positive impacts for girls with lower rates of depression and conduct disorders. But their findings were a little bit mixed and not as consistent for boys, where they saw some potential increases in rates of depression and post-traumatic stress and conduct disorders. But I think as a practicing pediatrician and a researcher and someone who's had some exposure to kind of translating research and cumulative bodies of research into policy efforts, I think it's really important to note that nationwide pediatricians recognize that child poverty is a major threat to our children's health, and that we also recognize that the effects of poverty aren't just those effects felt at the family level. So growing up in a poor family is definitely can have detrimental impacts on health, but too often poor families live in poor communities. And it's that cumulative exposure to the stresses associated with living in communities of disadvantage or areas of concentrated poverty on top of the stress associated with being poor yourself that really over the lifetime can have incredibly detrimental effects on the health trajectories of kids who otherwise, you know, start out most of the time with a pretty good chance of staying healthy and growing up on a healthy trajectory if they're not faced with too many sort of environmental insults on their health, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. You know, we were just speaking with Raj Chetty, who's with two colleagues at Harvard, two economists, did this new research on MTO. And earlier research by social scientists and psychologists, economists who looked at this, early results were kind of disappointing. Now he's saying, now this new research conducted over a longer period of time or looking at data from a longer period of time seems to, you know, confirm that moving kids out of poverty early in life makes a difference. And from your look at the research on health outcomes for kids, are you convinced that this is a possible remedy, a remedy for more kids that would have better outcomes? Is the evidence clear to you?
I think there's a lot of compelling evidence that doing things to interrupt the intergenerational cycle of poverty and disadvantage for children can have long-lasting positive impacts on their health. And I think, you know, Raj's work is just, it's really exciting from the standpoint of the fact that they're specifically looking at the economic outcomes for the next generation, as opposed to being solely focused on looking at the economic outcomes for the parents who moved. And I think it really speaks to this idea that when you change the environments where children live and when you provide them with additional supports and when we invest in our children, it actually reaps economic benefits for society and has the potential to. And on top of that, it can definitely potentiate health benefits for those individual children. I think another area where there have been some really interesting work by leading economists coupled with amazing work by researchers specifically focused on child well-being and outcomes is in the area of early childhood interventions, and that investing in preschool programs has been shown when the programs are rigorously structured and provide supports to parents as well, to also have these same kinds of economic impacts for the children. And similar to what I think Raj alluded to, this idea that these economic impacts are also coupled with improvements in health. So improvements in mental health, improvements in health behaviors, decreases in out-of-wedlock and teen births. I think all of these things can be related to economics and can be related to, the ability that a child has to, as they transition into adulthood, to be gainfully employed, to, to become a productive member of society. And, you know, on top of that, I think we know that the stressors that children experience early in life can have long-lasting impacts for even their cardiovascular health and their metabolic health, so relating to things like obesity, diabetes, heart disease. So I think there is a body of evidence that would suggest we have some strategies that we could act on that, that could yield really important health benefits for kids. That's not to say they'd be easy strategies to implement, and I think you have alluded to that when you talk about some of the political challenges
right.
to investing in these types of programs to help children and ultimately to help families do the best by their children, which as a pediatrician in practice here in Baltimore, working with a lot of families who face tremendous, you know, poverty and disadvantage, these are parents who really care and who want the best for their kids as well. And supporting the children is something that also requires, you know, supporting the family and empowering the parents to really do their best.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that from personal experience. Dr. Rachel Johnson Thornton, our guest here on Midday. As a pediatrician, what do you hear from parents who live in low-income neighborhoods? What are their concerns? What health issues do their kids face?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so we're in the process of, so I can tell you both, you know, from my anecdotal experiences one-on-one with patients, and then also because we're in the process of analyzing some data from focus groups that we've conducted at the Children's Medical Practice and our sister clinic on the main East Baltimore medical campus as well, talking to parents specifically about the barriers in their neighborhoods that, you know, potentially get in the way of them being able to do what they'd ideally like to do with respect to their children's, you know, diet and physical activity behaviors and things of that nature. I can say on a one-on-one basis, I'm very fortunate to work in a clinic where we have wraparound supports, including the Health Leads program, which is a program that's staffed by student volunteers who help our families with a lot of the social supports they may need, including access to food, assisting them with application for public benefits, assisting them with employment and housing and early childhood programs. And we have amazing social work support that can really intervene when families are in times of crisis and has helped us to identify some of those families who really struggle from month to month to have enough food to put on the table for their kids. But I do hear parents, you know, talk to me anecdotally about a variety of concerns, both, you know, the concerns they have about making sure their kids are getting enough to eat and trying to do their best to ensure that those are healthy foods, but being sometimes challenged that, you know, the healthy options aren't always the most accessible options in their neighborhoods or aren't always the most affordable options for them. And then I think the issues around safety and crime are something else that I think a lot of families articulate. And to be completely honest with you, in the context of, you know, the recent events that have transpired after the death of Mr. Gray, you know, I can tell you that me and many of my colleagues have talked to parents who feel like their children are just growing up facing a variety of threats, that they recognize the challenges that their children face just from the neighborhood environment, from, you know, being in areas that are not particularly safe, where there may be illicit activity and crime, where there's, you know, higher concentration of alcohol outlets, where there's sort of a concern that their children are going to be in harm's way if they're outside of their homes. And for some of my parents, you know, this is compounded by the fact that they also have concern that their children, as they transition, particularly from, you know, cute young toddlers into, you know, young men and boys and who start to look like men in their early teenage years, that they may even, you know, be unfairly targeted by law enforcement, depending on, you know, just by virtue of where they live or the route they take to get home from school or to go to different activities. And I think some parents are really vigilant about ensuring that their children in general, and sometimes their, you know, African-American male children in particular, are sheltered from the risk of these, you know, sort of multiple potentially negative exposures they might face in their communities, or these multiple threats to their healthy trajectory, whether it's a, you know, a true threat or a perceived threat. And I can tell you that I'm not the only one in our practice who's heard families kind of articulate these concerns that, you know, the only safe place is inside the four walls of their home. You know, and that's, we want children to be able to enjoy their neighborhoods, and we know that, you know, exercise and being outdoors and having opportunities to develop healthy social relationships are really important for their development and their mental health. And so so I think those combination of factors are things that parents often are faced with and challenged with in trying to do the best by their children when they're living in neighborhoods that, you know, may not be currently really well equipped to support the healthy development and growth of those kids.
Well, speaking of that, Dr. Thornton, have you heard parents express, mothers say they would move if they could, or they would like to move out of the neighborhoods they live in East Baltimore or West Baltimore, wherever?
You know, I mean, and like I said, in the process of analyzing our focus group data, one of the interesting things is, you know, we were trying to get people to talk to us about the neighborhoods where they are now and what the barriers in those neighborhoods are and what they'd ideally like to see in a place that they'd want to live. And we asked them about sort of the characteristics of their ideal neighborhoods. And like I said, we're in the midst of data analysis, so nothing's finalized, but I can tell you that, you know, parents would identify other areas of our state that they sort of had some experience with as a positive place to raise children. I think they talked about having green space where their kids could play outdoors safely. I oftentimes hear people talk about wanting to have a neighborhood environment where there's neighbors that they can feel they can rely on and trust, who have the best interest of all the children in the neighborhood at heart, and where there's a real sense of community. And I don't mean to say that that doesn't exist in Baltimore, because, you know, I think that exists everywhere where there's good people who really care, and there's a lot of those kind of people here in our city. But I think that the parents, my interpretation of what they're expressing is that there are so many challenges in some of the neighborhoods where they live, that even if those people do exist, they just don't feel safe enough to even explore and identify the members of the community who might share those same values and interests. And then I think they're also articulating the fact that, I mean, when we look at the statistics, there are clear differences in the amenities and resources available in a wealthy or more affluent area versus an area of concentrated poverty, and the crime rates and the exposure to crime and the exposure to environments that serve as magnets for crime are different, and those are realities that I think families are facing.
Hey, one last thing I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Thornton, before we take our break and say goodbye to you. Cognitive development in kids and their success in school. Has there been an evaluation done of moving kids to opportunity in that regard? You get better health outcomes, better cognitive development if they move to areas like that and do better in school or in better school environments?
Yeah, I'm less familiar with the details of the school outcomes that have been evaluated in Moving to Opportunity. I know that that is an area that was an area of focus within Moving to Opportunity. And also, I have to say that I have a wonderful colleague in the Department of Sociology, Stephanie DeLuca, who has done a lot of work.
She's been on our show here. Yeah.
With Moving to Opportunity and with the current the current program that you mentioned earlier, where 2,800 families have moved to high opportunity areas,
mm-hmm.
that where she's specifically looking at the impact on school outcomes. And,
oh, good.
You know, I think it's...
Are you deferring to her then?
So I defer
okay.
to her for a more detailed answer on that.
Right.
But I do think it's another one of those areas potentially where there's this cumulative effect that, you know, the earlier you can transition a child, potentially the more positive the outcomes are going to be for them.
Well, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Enjoy the conversation and learn something here. Dr. Rachel Johnson-Thornton is an assistant professor in the Departments of Pediatric and Health Behavior and Society at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and she is a pediatrician at the Children's Medical Practice at Johns Hopkins Bayview. David Rusk is going to join us again, who was on our show last week, the urban scholar, author of Baltimore Unbound, for a couple of follow-up questions. So you can call in if you have questions for David Rusk after this short break. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. That new large study by Raj Chetty and colleagues at Harvard that we've been talking about in this hour of the show finds that based on the earnings records of millions of families that moved with children, it finds that poor children who grow up in some cities and towns have sharply better odds of escaping poverty than similar poor children elsewhere. In Baltimore finished dead last in their review of this look at upward mobility for children who move. Every year a poor boy spends growing up in Baltimore, his earnings as an adult fall by 1.5%. This is how the Washington Post interpreted that. Add up an entire childhood, and that means a 26-year-old man in Baltimore earns about 28% less than he would if he had grown up somewhere in average America, even right outside the city in Baltimore County or Howard County. And that's a whole lot less, says the Post, than the very same child would earn if he had grown up 50 miles away in Fairfax County. Last week on the show, urban scholar David Rusk, author of Baltimore Unbound 20 years ago in 1995, joined us on the show to talk about the high concentration of poverty in Baltimore and how that is creates a difficult problem, not only for Baltimore and for people who live in poverty, for the greater city, but for the region in general. David Rusk joins us again to follow up a little bit because we had a couple more questions for him. David, thank you for making time for us again on Midday.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. Let me remind you and the listening audience that these days I have to hear through a cochlear implant. Which is a wonderful technology. I mean, I'd be stone deaf without it. But I'm listening. I'm fielding this phone call with a caption call service, and they may not be willing to try to translate caption any call that comes in from a caller.
Okay.
So if that should happen, I may have to ask you just to repeat the comment or the question from a caller for me.
Understood, David. Thank you. Well, my question is a question that was posed by a couple of callers after you were on the air with us last week. These callers are imagining a poor city neighborhood, a few city blocks, where poor people are given vouchers from the housing department to move to low poverty areas, move their families out. And people wonder, well, what happens to the inner city? What happens to those neighborhoods? Do they empty out and become abandoned? There seemed to be a concern about that. So I thought I would ask you about it.
Well, it's a fair question. And first of all, one has to look at some of the intrinsic values of the neighborhood in terms of its housing stock, in terms of its location in relation to jobs. There certainly are neighborhoods in Baltimore that don't have either of those going for them. But generally, when you're looking at folks moving away, you're talking about a sort of a one-at-a-time process. And indeed, when you're talking in neighborhoods of an historic character and that have access to a strong job market and are appealing to middle-class families to move back in, that also tends to be a one-to-one process. So I'm not sure that It's a very, very thoughtful question, but I'm not sure that in reality it really works out that way. The real question is what do you do when there's, you know, total clearance? And I'm thinking about some of the areas. Well, certainly where they had the high-rise apartments, public housing that was knocked down and then rebuilt, and it's very important that be rebuilt on the basis of mixed-income housing.
Right.
And I guess it was Lafayette Courts that was the first and converted into Pleasant View Estates over there not too far from Johns Hopkins. That was rebuilt as 90% public housing families and 10% market rate, but very modest market rate at that. So I think that's still kind of a fragile situation. On the other hand, I don't know whether it was Flag House or the other project. I can't think of it right now.
Well, there were Murphy Homes and there were Lafayette Courts as well.
Well, Lafayette Courts was the second.
Yeah.
But the fourth in the line was about 35% public housing, 65% market rate. And I think that's probably a very viable balance.
So, David, I'm going to take another question for you. We'll take our first question for David Rusk. This is Chris. And, Chris, if David doesn't hear your question, I'll just repeat it for him, okay? Chris, are you there?
Thank you for taking my call.
Okay. Go ahead and ask your question, and I'll repeat it for David if he can't hear it.
Okay, great. So we actually live in the site of the old Flag House project. I'm a middle-income resident here living in Jonestown. And we've had a very positive experience living in a mixed-income neighborhood. We were curious, though, about, you know, other middle- to higher-income families and kind of their perspectives of living in one of these areas and if it's been hard to keep those residents staying here to give the benefits to the lower-income neighbors.
Now, David, I don't know if you could read that question. If not,
I did, and the wonderful captionings people captioned that, as a matter of fact. The folks that have had the longest experience with this is Montgomery County, Maryland. And very careful studies have been done, which show, first of all, that many middle-class homers have some concern for what might be the impact upon the value of the home they own. And the studies have shown that there's no impact because the proportions are modest, the affordable homes are architecturally very compatible. If they're owned by the Housing Authority makes sure that that the tenants are good neighbors. And, it's just sort of recreating in a setting the way cities used to be, frankly. And there's no pattern in terms of social agencies, et cetera, in Montgomery County that they can ascribe to with regard to any problems that come up from that mix. So I think if you recognize that your new neighbors are really working folk too, they're probably the checker at the local grocery store or the orderly down at the nursing home 2 miles away or the like, and just see them as neighbors, things work very well.
Another question for David Rusk. This one from Saeed in Baltimore. Saeed, go right ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call. The question I have is that we've done this for large companies to give them actually tax-free or reduced tax for properties to bring them in. Why don't we do that for vacant houses and have people come in for 5 to 10 years of reduced property tax and try to improve the population that we have within the city and try to kind of actually dilute down the poor population by bringing the influx? And one of the suggestions is reduction in tax for properties for those who are coming in. or for college students who are graduating.
Okay, Saeed. Saeed is suggesting more incentive for middle-class
right.
families to live in, so you have more integrated, economically integrated neighborhoods potentially.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think that's a very valid goal for tax abatement. But also, I think you've had a variation on that in Baltimore's own history. My recollection, I may be wrong, is that in the Otterbein area, the city sold abandoned properties to new residents for a dollar on the basis that they would invest to fix it up and live in it. So getting a home for a dollar, which obviously you've got to do a lot of work on it, but one which I suspect the values in the Otterbein neighborhood now are very, very healthy indeed, so that if that family that moved in to an abandoned home and fixed it up and living in it now sell it, they probably are selling it for several hundred thousand dollars.
That's a subject I'm planning on revisiting for my column in The Sun. Michael, with the next question, please be brief, Michael. We're getting short on time.
I'll be real brief in a comment. I've lived in East Baltimore, and I want to make one comment about what's happened in Lafayette Courts when that happened. But I just want to make one brief comment. The fact is that the fallout from Lafayette Courts was a highest concentration of Section 8 housing in East Baltimore, which didn't do much good for East Baltimore. The question I have is in regard to housing in charter schools, is that we now have charter schools taking over lots of the population. However, what's left over again is we have high concentrations of the folks that we would like to see some changes in are now overcrowded in our quote-unquote real public schools. I would like you to comment on those factors. Thanks.
Let me comment about the whole school question, because I think you had a previous speaker that was just on before I came on, who was from the Johns Hopkins Public Health Department, who was talking about the very positive impact of having low-income children in middle-class schools, and the younger the better in terms of the impact. There has been a very major study by Heather Schwartz for the Century Foundation. It was her doctoral dissertation at Columbia University that found that looked at Montgomery County public schools in detail and found that the children that from public housing that lived in county-owned townhouses and rented apartments in higher-income neighborhoods did famously in the schools. They closed the gaps very quickly, whereas those children that were in lower-income and with more concentrated conditions, at least in the context of Montgomery County, after some initial improvement, started falling behind again. So, I mean, economic integration works in that context. I think what should have happened in the East Baltimore area, and still can, was what we did once in Albuquerque. At the instigation of a very far-sighted neighborhood group representing a very poor neighborhood next to downtown, the elementary school was rebuilt. The school board committed to putting in a top-quality curriculum for the children. The city paid the school board extra to open the school and run it from 7 in the morning until 6 in the evening. And by agreement of everybody, the enrollment policy was that no more than half the children would come from the neighborhood. Those were children who were very poor. The other half of the seats in the school were reserved for the children of downtown office workers nearby. And that was wildly popular with downtown office workers because they would much rather bring their child with them to school, drop them off two or three blocks from where they were, and so we really had the possibility of doing that with so much concentrated employment at Johns Hopkins Medical Center.
David Rusk, our guest here on Midday again, following up from our conversation last week. Thank you very much, David. Thanks again for your time.
Okay, thank you, Ben.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the first hour of Midday. I hope you enjoyed the program. Please stick around for the second hour coming up on Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell. So please stay tuned for that.